from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz will formally resign January 13th. Also today, Senate President Stan Rosenberg talks about possible criminal justice reforms.
We're going to have to prioritize this because every dollar we invest in helping people reenter society and not come back in the front door of a jail is going to save a lot of money.
And homeless families sue the Baker administration for not getting emergency shelter. We'll talk with a mom who fought to get temporary housing.
It was like 20-something degrees outside, and I had to have the heater running, and that way my kids are warm and safe.
Plus, author Joseph Finder about why he decided to write about spying.
I just think that fiction is really great as a way to explore our inner lives.
That's Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We begin today with the announcement from Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz that she will be stepping down January 13th. The move is not unexpected, as President-elect Trump will name the next U.S. attorney for the state. But joining us now is the person who held the office before Ortiz, Michael Sullivan. He was former Massachusetts U.S. attorney from 2001 to 2009. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb. Good speaking with you.
Nice to speak with you, too. So explain to us this process of stepping down a little bit, just so we understand it.
Yeah, sure. It's actually a pretty simple process. The administration you serve under, the president asks all of then his presidential appointees to tender letters of resignation, effective the date of the incoming president's swearing in, which is obviously January 20th. So all the presidential appointees present and have available for the incoming administration letters of resignation. And then the president, the administration acts on those letters of resignation. In some instances, on that specific date, the 20th of January, in some cases, they hold a letter of resignation for a period of time during the course of a transition from one administration to the next.
So nothing unusual here.
It is not unusual at all. Obviously, Carmen Ortiz is stepping down in advance of the new administration, but it's not unusual at all for U.S. attorneys to anticipate their resignation either around the date of the incoming administration or shortly thereafter. I would say U.S. attorneys, it's a process. I think confirmed a couple of days after 9/11 in 2001. So the process does take several months to get the new U.S. attorney in place.
So then what happens? I mean, is there an interim, or who runs things for those months while we wait for the next person to take over?
Yeah, there'd be typically an acting United States attorney. In most instances, it would fall to the first assistant United States attorney that is working on behalf of the current U.S. attorney. In this particular case, it would be Bill Weinrab, who's the first assistant United States attorney. He would serve as the acting U.S. attorney during the period in which there's a vacancy in the U.S. attorney's office. Prior to me becoming U.S. attorney, Jim Farmer, who was then the criminal chief of the U.S. attorney's office, but the highest ranking assistant United States attorney, served as the acting U.S. attorney after Dawn Stern resigned, who is my predecessor.
And typically, the U.S. attorney is recommended by senators from the home state. In Carmen Ortiz's case, nominated by the late Senator Edward Kennedy. Is that typically how it works? And would that have to happen again?
Well, it typically works that way in those states in which there's a sitting United States senator that is of the same party as the executive branch. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, there isn't, and which is very similar to my case, because when I get nominated, initially recommended then to the White House and then nominated by the President of the United States, we didn't have a sitting Republican United States senator, but we we had a sitting Republican governor, and the White House at that point in time solicited recommendations from then the late Governor RGL Paul Sulichu.
So it would be likely that Governor Baker might be called upon to make this recommendation for the next U.S. attorney.
Well, it could be, and that's not completely clear at this point in time. I think under normal circumstances that would be the case, but I'm confident that the Trump administration has a process in place with regards to solicit names for purposes of recommendations and vetting for key positions like the United States Attorney position. That's not the only one that the president will be nominating, and the Senate will be called upon to confirm at some point in time. The unusual fact here, obviously, is Governor Jolly Baker indicated that he was not supportive of presidential candidate Donald Trump. So I don't know, what, if anything, impact that might have in terms of where, the administration will be soliciting or vetting names from. Confident that Governor Baker will have at least an opportunity to, weigh in the process. But I would believe the incoming Trump administration has a process.
Okay, we have a little bit of time. I just want to make sure we get to legacy a little bit here and then possible successors. So first of all, legacy. Just Monday, a court of appeals overturned three convictions in the big case that was before Ortiz, which was the state probation department. She also received a lot of criticism for charges against Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide after he was charged with downloading academic articles. I mean, there have been some allegations of overreach on her part. Do you think that's part of her legacy?
Well, the U.S. attorney position is a challenging position, and if you're looking to make friends, I would suggest you not consider taking on the responsibilities as U.S. attorney, because oftentimes you have to take on matters against, in some instances, very popular people or popular companies, or take on some controversial matters. And I think at the end of the day, as long as you've been faithful to your oath, and you can look yourself in the mirror and realize that you've done the best you possibly could under the circumstances, you should leave feeling very good about the work of the office. I'm sure that there'll be critics out there that believe that Carmen Ortiz has overreached in some instances. I'm confident that there were critics that had similar viewpoints concerning my service as a U.S. attorney as well. But, at the end of the day, I think what's, important is whether or not you are doing the work for all the right reasons, notwithstanding the fact that you're never going to be 100% right. There are going to be circumstances in which either time or facts or evidence will determine that maybe it wasn't the right decision. But if you made the best possible decision at the time you made it, I think you leave the office feeling.
Well, she's also had some hugely high profile cases. Obviously, the Boston Marathon bombing, Shahar Tsarnaev, Whitey Bulger, big cases during her tenure. How do you describe her legacy?
I think the office is bigger than one person. I think it's much bigger than the U.S. attorney, even though the U.S. attorney plays a critically important role in terms of the allocation of resources and the priorities, but I think the successes, I think, reflect the rich talent that you have the opportunity to work with, the tremendous dedicated law enforcement agencies that are critically important in terms of the success of the office, and that goes from local to state, the county to the federal law enforcement agencies. So, I think at the end of the day, I think Carmen will look back and say that she had the opportunity to do some very interesting, some very challenging, and some very rewarding things. I suspect she'll look back and wish that she had another opportunity on a few of them, and maybe she would have done them differently had she had another opportunity.
What are one or two names that you think might be floated as possible successors? Any ideas?
There's a whole list of them. Certainly that people are very much interested. It's a coveted position. It has a huge impact in terms of things like public policy for the District of Massachusetts. You have an opportunity to do some very exciting things. You know, I look back and I had the opportunity to participate in international investigations, make relationships beyond, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, across the country and across the world. I know that there are a number of names that have been floated. I'd rather not weigh in on any of the names at this point in time. And, a lot of them are very talented, people.
Mm-hmm. So, but do you expect that'll be soon, or maybe not so soon?
I think it takes several months for the process really to be completed. The president is putting together, president-elect is putting together his cabinet positions, the deputy cabinet positions, and then there'll be a process. There are 93 United States attorneys from around the country, and each one of those positions, takes some time, and there'll be a lot of interest in each one of them. So there's a process, in place, and it'll take some time for the whole vetting, the background checks, for the president and the president's team to make sure they're getting, excellent, people, to serve as United States attorneys.
Okay. Former Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Deb. Good talking to you. Thank you.
You too. Last year, state leaders announced a review of the criminal justice system in Massachusetts that Senate President Stan Rosenberg said would help the state be both tough and smart on crime. That investigation, conducted by the Council of State Governments, is due to wrap up in the next month. Some critics, including the Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, have said that their recommendations do not go far enough on issues such as sentencing reform and mandatory minimum sentences. A group of protesters interrupted a meeting about that report today.
The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated.
Senate President Rosenberg is a member of the steering committee of the Massachusetts Criminal Justice Review, and we spoke with him earlier today and started by asking him about his reaction to the report and the response.
People are responding at this point to an interim document, which is not the final document. There are several more weeks of work yet to be done. There's, in fact, I think two more meetings of the steering committee, so I know it's not finished work yet. So I think people are beginning to react because they're seeing drafts and they're not seeing everything they'd like to see in it. The way I view it is we ask the Council of State Governments to come into the state and do an analysis, and we ask them to compare our practices to the best practices around the country. But this report will not be the last word, because legislation will follow and debate in both the House and the Senate will follow that.
Mm-hmm. But so you do think that sentencing reform will be included? I mean, we've heard from the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus that they want it in there. Other folks who are working on criminal justice?
I don't know whether it will be in there. I am an advocate for reviewing our mandatory sentencing here in the Commonwealth. We did some review and we removed and reduced some in previous legislation, which is already in practice in the Commonwealth, so we made progress on that front. I think we can still do more, and whether the report recommends it or not doesn't mean that it won't be a matter of debate and there won't be an opportunity to consider doing it. But this will evolve over time. So this report is not the be-all, end-all.
Mm, but I do want to say, I covered it a year ago when it first started, the first hearing, and when the council and state government representatives and others were at the State House, and they talked about some of the issues that they wanted to look at and some preliminary data. And they did say then that they were going to look at sentencing. And they also said that they were going to look at things about discrepancies around the state of Massachusetts and what that might mean. I remember one statistic that was striking in particular. They said in Berkshire County, for example, what they noticed that between 2009 and 2015, there was a 52% decline in jail population in Berkshire County. During that same time in Middlesex County, there was a 35% increase in the jail population. So why would there be such wide discrepancies in one state? Does that have to do with, say, discretion on the part of police and courts? And they were going to look at issues like that. Are these things, I mean, this is a year in the making here now. I know you can't say what's going to be in the final report, but certainly much of the work has been done at this point. Are things like discretion and possibly more sentencing reform than what has already been done by the legislature, is that going to be included, do you think, as you move forward?
I believe that before this debate is finished, that subject will be thoroughly vetted and thoroughly debated in the legislature, whether it's in the report or it's not in the report. I can't speak to the specific data point that you raised, but it certainly is troubling to hear that kind of data point, and it leads to questions as to why that is occurring.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there has been enough done to address mandatory minimum sentences in Massachusetts at this point?
I'd like to see us continue the review, and I think we can do some more.
Mm-hmm. I know that the researchers suggested at the beginning of this that there is an estimated 40% recidivism rate among those who are incarcerated in Massachusetts. Do you know at this point how that compares to other states?
So I think the recidivism rate is actually higher than that. That said, you have to differentiate between the state prison system and the county jails mm-hmm. when you're doing the data analysis. And I don't know exactly what the data shows on that at this moment. But every state that's been through this exercise has been able to reduce recidivism if they use the best practices. And that's why there's been so much focus in this process with CSG on looking at reentry and what we could do to improve reentry. Because in virtually every state where they did a good job after CSG had been in working with them, they reduced rather dramatically the number of people who came back in the front door with a second or third or fourth offense. So that is a big, big part of the focus of the discussion that we've been having. Because although our prison population is still too high, in the opinion of many of us, we actually have on a per capita basis relatively low incarceration rate when compared to the rest of the country. So there's been a lot of focus on what do we do at the back end of the system, because there are two ways to get into the system, your first offense and every offense that follows. Mm. And so if you are successful at reducing, at improving reentry and reducing reincarceration at the back end, you also reduce your prison population.
So I know you said that reentry and dealing with reentry is a main issue. And I know that probably not everyone is going to be happy with what comes out of this, right? Because there are an awful lot of issues related to criminal justice reform, and you can't please everybody. I understand that. But if you could name the top three priorities that you hope come out of this, what would they be?
Want to see reduction in incarceration and reincarceration. I'm looking for appropriate handling of people with mental illness and substance abuse problems. They belong in treatment. They don't belong in jail. And I'm hoping that we can take advantage of the benefits that come from looking at ways of resolving conflict in society that don't involve putting people through the court system. If we can find ways of moving people through diversion or through restorative justice programs, mediation, there will be fewer people going into jail, and yet we will not have compromised public safety.
This review is being conducted against the backdrop of new details coming out about Sonia Farrick, who's a former state chemist who admitted to stealing drugs from a state lab in Amherst, drugs that were supposed to be used as evidence in criminal cases. Lawyers for 10 defendants claim that the state attorney general's office at the time under former AG Martha Coakley covered up some of this misconduct. And then, of course, we had the Annie Ducon case, another former state chemist who was convicted of tampering with drug evidence, and she went to prison for a couple of years. So we've got thousands of cases potentially compromised, and we're talking about criminal justice reform. Do you think this report is going to address forensic testing at all, particularly because of what's happened in Massachusetts? One person called it the worst drug scandal in the history of the country. Will it?
So I don't have a lot of background in that, but just yesterday I was in a conversation with staff, and I said, "How will the work that we do in criminal justice reform affect the folks who were involved in those particular cases?" And they said they would do a review and get me some information because they didn't have it off the top of their heads, and it did come to mind yesterday, and we are going to do some more research on that.
What's your time frame, do you think, before we might see a final report and maybe some legislation or at least work beginning on legislation on the part of lawmakers?
So the CSG report, which is will be a collection of recommendations and analysis, should be out in the middle of January, and the deadline for filing legislation for the next term is, I think, the third or fourth Friday in January. So very soon thereafter, you'll see a lot of legislation. We're going to have to prioritize this because every dollar we invest in helping people reenter society and not come back in the front door of a jail is going to save a lot of money. It's a lot less expensive to do that work than it is to pay for an individual to be incarcerated for months and years at a time.
Okay. Senate President Stan Rosenberg, a member of the Steering Committee of the Massachusetts Criminal Justice Review, thanks so much for being with us.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. Coming up, the lawsuit by homeless families against the Baker administration. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Five homeless families are suing the administration of Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, claiming they've been denied emergency housing and that the state is hurting vulnerable people because of a promise that Baker made during his campaign for office. Governor Baker strongly denies that and says his administration has delivered on his campaign promise to move homeless parents and children from state-sponsored motels into more family-friendly environments. The latest numbers from the state indicate that about 3,600 families are in emergency shelter, 140 of those in hotels or motels paid for by the state. Joining us to talk more about this is Kelly Turley, Director of Legislative Advocacy at the Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless. Thanks for being with us, Kelly.
Thank you so much.
So we mentioned the lawsuit against the Baker administration from five homeless families alleging that the state is illegally denying them shelter. We should say you're not a part of this lawsuit, but can you elaborate a little bit more on what it means?
Sure. Right now, there are thousands of families across Massachusetts who are experiencing homelessness and housing instability who are searching for shelter, and the state is the main provider of shelter for families in Massachusetts. So if a family is unable to receive shelter from the state's Department of Housing and Community Development, or is unable to receive an adequate placement, it really puts families and children in a difficult position. And so we're seeing that right now. The state's numbers show that half of all families who apply for shelter are being denied. Since July 1st, that's from July 1st till October 31st, that was 1,765 families denied.
Wow. And how does that compare with other years? Do you know? I mean, is it higher?
It's around the same each year. The past couple of years has been around 48% to 52%, but the volume of families applying for shelter is very high, higher than in many of the previous years because of the very low vacancy rates of apartments, the very low incomes of families who are seeking shelter.
Now, Massachusetts is the only state in the country, though, that is supposed to guarantee emergency shelter for families. So how is it that so many are being denied?
Massachusetts is considered a right to shelter state, but it comes with a big asterisk that only families who meet the very narrow eligibility criteria are guaranteed access to shelter. So families have to meet the income eligibility guidelines. They couldn't have been in shelter in the past year. They have to show that their homelessness is related to domestic violence, fire, flood, natural disaster, a no-fault eviction, or a very severe health and safety risk. And so many of the families seeking shelter are unable to provide documentation that they fall into one of those categories, even if they actually do fall into one of the categories. So we're seeing many families that are staying in places not meant for human habitation, aren't able to prove that, families that are fleeing domestic violence and hadn't spoken out and had a restraining order, for example, or families that are in double-up situations that are very dangerous, but the state doesn't see it that way.
You know, many folks would think that the economy's better, things are better, right? Mm-hmm. There should be fewer families who need this type of assistance. That's not what I'm hearing from you.
Unfortunately, the economy has gotten better overall, but not for the lowest income families and individuals. And Massachusetts is ranked as one of the least affordable states in the country. There was just a report, an article today in Boston Magazine about the Boston metro area being ranked the second worst for renters, right behind New York City. And so we're seeing families that are experiencing housing instability and homelessness turning to the state because they aren't able to make it in the current economy.
Now, we should go back, if we go back to this lawsuit against the Baker administration regarding families saying that they were denied emergency shelter, Governor Baker did issue a statement saying, you know, this is not happening. There's no one doing this deliberately. What he says is, you know, I made a promise to get people out of hotels. We all know that that's not an ideal situation. So could it be, do you think, just an unintended consequence of the Baker administration trying to get these families out of what really isn't a good situation and trying to find something better, and maybe more people are being denied, but in the long run, it's a step toward a better system?
At the Coalition for the Homeless, we work closely with many members of the Baker administration, so we don't want to cast aspersions. And we know that they are working hard to make sure that families are connected to the resources that they need. But the reality is that on a day-to-day basis, we see families who are turned away, who are delayed in getting placements, and have to meet very high standards of verifications in order to access the services. There is a provision in the line item that governs the family shelter program that talks about placing families presumptively if they appear to be eligible. And that's not being used at the level that it needs to be. As you can imagine, if you and your children were experiencing homelessness, fleeing a bad situation, doubling up, moving around night to night, you may not have all of the paperwork to prove your housing history, where you've been, that you're eligible for shelter. And that regulation, which was put in by the legislature, that language, is really important to making sure that families get at least a provisional placement while they're proving ongoing eligibility. And we're seeing that that is not used on a regular basis. And that is cause for part of the problems that are raised in the lawsuit.
We spoke earlier today with a mom, Lynette Martin. She grew up in Framingham, moved to Oklahoma, came back to Framingham because she wanted to be here with two children who are autistic and her husband. They're both working and they're struggling. They do have temporary housing now, but I guess the state is trying to find a more permanent placement for them, but they may have to move further away. Is that what you're seeing as well? Because of what you mentioned in terms of renting costs and housing costs, or does the state look at it and say, well, you know, you make $11 an hour, so you have to live in, you know, closer to the, you know, the Berkshires or something? Is that how it works?
Right. We're seeing that families like Lynette's, even when they are able to access shelter, many of them are placed far away from their home community, far away from supports. As you mentioned in Lynette's case, that her children have special needs. And so staying close to their home school community where they're able to receive the individualized education plans and having that continuity is really important. We've worked with other families in recent days who have severe medical needs, but we're told, well, there's hospitals in every part of the state, but it's not the providers that they are currently working with, who they feel comfortable with, who they have that rapport with. We see that there are families who are placed far away from their jobs. And unfortunately, that is a consequence of not using motels on a regular basis. We're not saying that motels are an ideal placement for families, but over the years, they provided the state with the flexibility to be able to offer placements close to a family's home community. And in order to help families exit homelessness, having as much stability and continuity as possible is really important. And so one of the unintended consequences, I think, of having a goal of absolutely ending motels is that we have fewer placements for families with disabilities that are close to their home community, fewer placements in areas that are where families are coming from, such as the greater Boston area, because it is more expensive to provide shelter in Boston. But the legislature, once again, also included language that directs the state to place families within 20 miles of their home community to make every effort to make sure that children are staying in their home schools. And so these competing interests, we see that how it's playing out now when there aren't motel spaces for families.
Hmm. All right. Kelly Trulli, Director of Legislative Advocacy for the Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And now we're going to talk sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hey, Deb.
So let's start with video footage that was released by the Scottsdale, Arizona police. It's tape of an encounter between a police officer and Michael Floyd, the Patriots wide receiver, after Floyd was found asleep at the wheel of his car with the engine running and his foot on the brake. Let's listen.
Scottsdale police, put your car in park. Unlock the doors. Turn your car off.
That encounter was December 12th, and days afterward, the Arizona Cardinals released Floyd. Just days later, the Patriots claimed him. Bill, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, it was interesting that under Arizona law, this guy was characterized as, quote, a super extreme DUI. This wasn't just a kind of I had one too many drinks. 45 days in jail is the mandatory sentence for what this guy has done. Bill Belichick apparently knows this because he was asked if he knew that. He said, yes, I know, and I'm not going to comment on it, which is pretty standard Bill Belichick. I don't know. You like to give people second chances. A lot of people get drunk and drive and kill people. Fortunately, this guy hasn't done that. So you like to give people second chances, but it also makes you wonder about whether this is an entirely wise acquisition.
Hmm. Well, what do you think the move says about the Patriots?
Well, I think it says that the Patriots are like every other football team. If they look at somebody and they think that that guy can help them on the field, they're likely to not pay too much attention to whatever other baggage he may bring along.
Even though, you know, we know the history of the Patriots. And just yesterday, coincidentally, Aaron Hernandez, former Patriots player, who's serving a life sentence for a 2013 murder, was in court for a pretrial hearing for a separate 2012 murder. So, you know, it's easy to jump, right, Bill, and say, haven't they learned a lesson here? But what do you make of that?
Hernandez is obviously an extreme example. But there are all kinds of examples throughout the National Football League of guys who have been hired despite criminal backgrounds. Hernandez, there were all kinds of warning signs that the Patriots might have picked up on before he was ever arrested for murder. And they simply don't. The basic question that teams tend to ask is, can the guy help me on the field? And if he can, they're likely to not pay too much attention to a lot of other things. The old Patriots, it used to be different. And, of course, the cliche has it that when Myra Kraft was alive, this sort of thing didn't happen. Mm. And she, of course, famously did tell her husband, team owner Robert Kraft, that under no circumstances should he continue to employ Christian Peters, who was, abused women and quite famously so when he was a college student.
But what does it say almost, about thinking about bad behavior then? I mean, has that changed at all? Is it, well, you know,
no, I don't see any evidence that it really has changed very much. I mean, maybe Bill Belichick knows more. Obviously, Bill Belichick knows more about this guy than I do and than we do. And perhaps he's making a judgment call. But these are not unrepresentative decisions by people in authority in places like the NFL.
And we also need to say something nice here. The Patriots did clinch the AFC East title over the weekend, so they are doing very well.
See,
so
that's unhappily the way most people probably look at it. Mm. That is the bottom line.
Right. So we just have a little bit of time left here, so we've got to get the Celtics in. They're currently ranked third in the Eastern Conference. How do you think they'll do for the rest of the season, Bill?
I'm very glad they're in the Eastern Conference, where the way they've been playing has enabled them to be third. In the Western Conference, they wouldn't be nearly that high in the rankings because the Western Conference has lots more really good teams. They're great fun to watch, especially when Isaiah Thomas is healthy and playing well, and it's great fun to hear Tommy Heinsohn shout, little guy, look at that little guy, because what's more fun than watching a tiny guy thread his way through the forest and score?
Bill Littlefield, our host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. If you recognize the name Nick Heller, then you've probably already read the most recent thriller by Joseph Finder. His latest book, Guilty Minds, is the third novel where Nick Heller is the lead character and is investigating a complicated conspiracy. Conspiracies are not only hallmarks of Finder's books, but they fit right in with his background as a Russian scholar and his one-time plan to become a spy. When we spoke with Finder earlier this year, we started by asking why he, an actual CIA recruit, decided to write suspense novels.
Yeah, I was a Russian studies major in college, and I was fluent in Russian. And I was very interested in Soviet politics and Soviet intelligence. And it's sort of a natural that I would have been recruited to the CIA because I sort of fit the profile of what they were looking for at that point. Mm. When I was shown the cubicle where I'd be sitting, translating Soviet economic journals from Russian to English, I remember thinking, this is not what I want to do. I really would like to do something more interesting, more exciting. And I decided at that point to try something I'd always wanted to do, which is to write fiction, to write thrillers, to write spy novels. And so it was a risky move on my part because I had a clear path chosen. But it turns out to be something that I really love.
Hmm. And so what did you do? You just started writing?
I gave myself 3 years to sell a book. So I started writing and writing and writing and rewriting, and I sent it to an agent, and it was rejected, and I went back and forth and back and forth. And during the process of rejection, I actually learned how to write a good thriller. I also read a bunch of the great thrillers, the great spy novels and crime novels, and took notes and sort of studied them. It was my own kind of personal graduate school in how to write a thriller. Mm. And then at the end of 3 years, within 3 years, I was able to sell the book to Viking in the U.S. and Pan in the U.K., and I was able to, and for enough money to support myself. So I just started writing the next one.
Who would you say are some of the writers who really shaped your writing?
It's a weird range, because when I was a kid, I loved the Ian Fleming James Bond novels. I think they were way above my head, frankly. I think there are references in there I did not understand at that point. I read, a little later on, I read Ken Follett's The Eye of the Needle and Robert Ludlum's Bourne novel, and I began to sort of become interested in trying to do something like that. But there was a whole range of influences from John le Carré to Eric Ambler to Graham Greene to the modern thriller novelist Nelson DeMille, for example. Mm. So it's a wide range. Mm.
Well, let's talk about having a protagonist in almost a series, if you will. Three of your books, as we said in the beginning, involve Nick Heller as the protagonist. He's a tough, sort of smart investigator, a private spy. He's got a strong sense of humor and sense of justice, but he's also somebody completely willing to break the rules, maybe
right.
Someone's nose even, to try to get done what he thinks needs to be done. Who's Nick Heller modeled after, and why go in this direction with your writing to have one protagonist in a series of books?
Well, it is interesting that when you publish a book, and you've published several, you often get readers coming up to you saying, are we going to have that character again? Will you do Adam again, or Jason, or whatever? And the thing is, when you're writing a standalone novel, you can't sort of take that one character whose life is upended and put him into another novel and have the same thing happen the next day or the next book. So I realized that there is this hunger that people have for the continuing characters. It's what makes us watch television shows and become sort of addicted to television shows or novels. But I wanted to write something that hadn't been done before. And I felt that the Private Eye novel had been done a million times and quite well. I wanted to do something different. So I discovered, talking to a friend of mine who was in the CIA, that a lot of CIA officers went private after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Huh. And they were basically doing for governments and for politicians and for private individuals the same kind of work they did before. So I had it. At that point, I realized private spy would be my character, something I hadn't done before. And I was able to sort of take this character, Nick Heller, and have him be an investigator who in each story investigates a different conspiracy. But he is a tough guy, but he's also very cerebral. He really thinks these things through. And he's got a sense of humor, and he turns out to be a great joy to write. And I get all kinds of emails from people who really love the character, Nick Heller. So I'm feeling that it's catching on, that it's starting to work.
I'm almost wondering, is there a little bit of you in there and what you would have been like had the CIA been more interesting to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a wish fulfillment, Joe Finder's words. All right, it's not the real me. I can't do any of the stuff that Nick Heller does. So believe me, it's wish fulfillment.
So in the book, you know, you write about, as we said, complicated conspiracies. In this one, in Guilty Minds, there's a story about journalism, and Nick Heller is hired to discredit a gossip website story that's
right.
about to appear that really goes after a U.S. Supreme Court justice. And you talk about the editorial process. You talk about internet news and privacy. Mm-hmm. And your other books have had a little bit about journalism in them as well, one involving a journalist who lost his job. Why is this an area of interest for you, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. One answer would be that when I was starting out learning how to write fiction, I also wrote a lot of nonfiction on the side. I did short pieces for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and places like that. And I became interested in the life of a journalist. I became interested in the sort of what was going on with journalism, just as an observer. And it seems to me now that with the rise of the internet, we're seeing a complete revolution in journalism. And I find it to be an interesting subject matter. I find it to be something that I am drawn to, even though I don't intend to do it. In the case of Guilty Minds, I was interested in the rise of websites like Gawker or TMZ, gossip websites that are able to put things up that aren't necessarily sourced accurately, that are not necessarily true, and get away with it. And that and the internet sort of amplifies this gossip so that it goes all over the world. It's incredibly powerful. And I thought, you know, this was, of course, I was writing this a couple of years ago before Gawker went out of business. I sort of realized that this was a great way to show the different kind of journalism that exists in the age of the internet, whether it's gossip or whether it's legitimate journalism, sort of doing battle with gossip websites.
Right. Now, obviously, you did a lot of research, not just about journalism and investigative journalism and online things, but there's a lot about technology in the book, the use of technology to help sort of figure things out and investigate the use of technology in journalism as well. So you obviously had to really look into that. At one point, I read that you interviewed various people about this, folks from internet security places, a Boston Globe investigative journalist.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how you balance the research and the writing part of this, especially when I'm told that your goal is to write one book a year. That's a tall order.
That's also a great question because when you write a book a year, you do not have time to fool around.
Hmm.
And I love doing research. It's probably my favorite part of the process. I love talking to people about what they do and finding out how things really work. So I find myself sort of having to restrain myself from doing any more research. I figure things out. I learn things. I make phone calls. I email people. I learn some really cool things, which I'm able to pass on to my readers. But, you know, the main thing is to write the story. So I limit my research to maybe 2 or 3 months. And then I spend the rest of the year working on writing the story and editing it, revising it. But the research is great. I mean, I love actually using fiction as a way to educate people. I know that sounds maybe a little pretentious because it's not an educational experience necessarily. It's an entertainment experience. But I like the idea of using fiction to disseminate information. And one of the things I learned really early on in my novel writing career, is that people will talk to me who would never talk to a journalist from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or whatever.
It's interesting.
They will talk and they'll speak openly. So people who work in classified material will talk to me because I'm writing fiction and they know their name's never going to appear in it. So I was able to actually find things out that I would not have been able to find out if I were a journalist.
Hmm. Now, the pacing in your book, it really keeps the reader, at least this one, me, reading quickly, right? I want to find out what happens next. I'm going, and suddenly I'm 100 pages in, right? Was that a technique that you had to learn, or how would you describe that process and why you pull a reader in like that?
Well, it's my theory that our attention span as a culture has gotten shorter and shorter. If you look at suspense movies from the 1940s or 50s, they're paced in a much slower way. Books were actually longer and tended to have a more deliberate pace to them as well. But I think that first movies and then television shows and then the internet, they've all kind of torqued our sense of pacing on our attention span, so that I basically feel I need to have short scenes that sort of come at you quickly and that turn the plot with each scene. In other words, there's a hook at the end of each scene. Mm. So, and it takes a fair amount of effort behind the scenes, but it's not what I want my readers to know. I want them to just sort of read and coast through it and glide through it as quickly as possible. But in order to make that work, you have to do a lot of work behind the scenes.
Right. You know, the Huffington Post reviewed Guilty Minds and said that in this book, Nick Heller did not come across as human as in your previous books that featured Heller. The reviewer suggested that maybe you relied too much on a reader's past knowledge of Heller, so someone coming new to your books might not engage with Heller as much. What do you think of that? Is that a valid point?
Nope, it's not about. I don't agree. That was actually written by someone who had read my other Nick Heller books. Mm. I write them so that anyone can pick up the book at any point in the series without having to read the first several ones. And in each book, I sort of bring out different aspects to Nick's personality and his background. But you don't need to know that from book to book. One book does not depend on the one before that. So I don't actually agree, and I don't think most of my readers agree either.
So what are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading a number of things. I'm reading a book called A Little Life. I'm reading, which is a novel that came out, I think, last year.
Right.
I actually tend to read more literary novels when I'm writing, when I'm full-blast writing. I like to read books about families and dysfunctional families and relationships and marriages. I just think that fiction is really great as a way to explore our inner lives, and I sort of find that kind of a useful adjunct to read this while I'm writing my entertainment novels, so that I can keep in mind that the interiority is also important as the action.
What advice do you give to writers, especially those who may want to write a similar type of book?
Well, a number of things. One is I tell them to read copiously. I mean, read a lot in the genre they want to write in. I mean, that's the best way to learn. I tell them also that rejection is part of this business. It takes most people a long time to get an agent to get published. And you've got to be pretty stubborn about it. But what I've found is that writers, people who really want to write, end up writing. Because it requires a kind of a stubbornness that, you know, to see it through rejections from agents or editors and that sort of thing. And the third thing I tell people is just write. Don't get too hung up on promotion and going on the internet and doing blogs and that sort of thing. Because the main thing you can do is to have another book for your readers to pick up.
I understand your next book will not feature Nick Heller. What are you working on next?
Yeah, it's another standalone. This is set partly in Boston and partly in Washington, D.C. It is also a conspiracy novel involving sort of an ordinary guy who gets caught up in something extraordinary. The thing is, I came up with this idea And I said to my editor, do you want me to do another Nick Heller novel, or do you want me to do the standalone? And he said, you know what, do whatever you want. Maybe we can alternate. So I decided I'll write the standalone, and the next book will be another Nick Heller, because the truth is, I actually miss writing that character. I really love writing it.
Joseph Finder is author of several books, including Suspicion, The Fixer, and his latest, Guilty Minds. He joined us back in August. You can read an excerpt of Guilty Minds at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.